Chris began his music career at a young age when his mom bought him a $10 guitar. Now, over 50 years later, he is still with it. For the past couple of decades, Chris has continued to record solo and with Herb Peterson with the Desert Rose Band. He continues to write music and has returned to his mandolin and bluegrass roots. Chris, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on Bakersfield and Beyond on KWMR.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Our show, Bakersfield and Beyond, has the privilege of exploring the Bakersfield sound, which is a confluence of sounds and has since taken a firm place in music history. Chris, what is the Bakersfield sound to you?
Well, to me, Amanda, it really came about. Here we have a vast segment of the population moving west from the Oklahoma Dust Bowl time and Texas, and also combined with the Depression. So you had two major calamities going on. You had an agricultural one, or rather weather-related, which destroyed their whole way of making a living, and the Depression, which also knocked everybody off the park bench there, so to speak. And they come west to California. So Bakersfield, being sort of in the middle of the state, in the agricultural section of the state, Fresno, Bakersfield, Modesto, that whole area, a lot of people came out here in that period. So we're talking early 30s and post-war, after the war was over, late 40s. And came out to work, came out and brought their music with them, being country music, string band music, old-timey music. And Bakersfield, of course, being also an oil town, so a lot of the guys went to work in the oil fields, a lot of guys worked in farming, and they'd go to clubs at night. And so out of that became the Bakersfield sound. Really, I would attribute the main architect would be Win Stewart. And he really came out of L.A. and then moved up there, I believe. I think he was raised down here and then went up to L.A. But this is not only Bakersfield, it encompassed the entire state. There was so much country music out here from that element coming out, from those folks coming out from the Texas, Oklahoma, Midwest area. And the Bakersfield sound once again, Win Stewart, who had at one time Merle Haggard working for him, who had Buck Owens working for him. Buck's the guy that gets the handle for the Bakersfield sound. And Buck would work at this club. I think it was called the Blackboard. I think so. I think that's the name of the club.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
But he played dance music, Amanda and Mike. He played dance music. These guys would come in on Saturday night, and they wanted to dance. And so he'd get these snappy shuffles going. And that was the sound. And Wynn did it, and then Haggard did it to some degree. He sort of refined it and did a little differently later on. And where did that sound come from? Really from Ray Price. Ray Price out of Nashville, originally out of Texas, I believe. But Ray was the first purveyor of the great country shuffle, that slow shuffle, which is no different in a sense musically than a blues shuffle. It's just a different scale, and it's a different same lyric. Boy, they're same lyric, and it's all about losing something, whether it's a relationship or your money or something. So the lyrical content was the same, and the approach is a little different from rhythm and blues or blues music to white country music. So there you have it. That's the Bakersfield sound, and it was snappy. It was upbeat. It was very high energy. It was, and here's another element that did not occur in Nashville, that in coming out to California, they also, working out in the fields, absorbed a lot of Hispanic music. My own theory, a lot of Hispanic music. I can tell on old Buck Owens records when they'd end a chorus and they'd loop up that end and it would sound like a mariachi song or a norteño song.
Yeah, and they also brought in a lot of the accordion sound.
Yeah, exactly.
And Buck's drummer Willie Cantu was Hispanic.
And the percussion, exactly. I think a lot of the percussion, adding percussion to some of the old timey music, kind of gave it that backbeat.
Yeah, and Willie played very simply, and it was all vocal driven. And Ralph Mooney was the great steel player who had passed away recently, like a week or two ago. Ralph. And Win Stewart actually helped define Ralph's sound. I mean, he worked with Win very early on in his life, and Win said, "This is the way you have, this is where you really have it, play like this, Ralph, play like this. And then Buck used him. And like I say, Merle Haggard, who was the great singer, Wynn was a great singer, Buck was a good singer. Merle refined it a bit, but that's basically it. There's a lot of stuff. And you've got to include Rose Maddox, the Maddox brothers. You've got to include, to some degree, Spade Cooley, who really operated down south in Los Angeles. And Spade did basically Western Swing. He was our Bob Wills. I grew up listening to Spade, watching Spade Cooley on television, on old black and white TV. Good, fuzzy, get him in. We'd have the aerial on the roof, and we were 80 miles almost, no, we were 100 and, gosh, we were about 115 miles from L.A. out in the San Diego County, very rural area, and I'd watch Spade Cooley.
Yeah. Where in San Diego County did you grow up?
Well, originally I lived in Rancho Santa Fe, which was a
right.
tiny little town. It's become a very wealthy enclave now.
Yes. I grew up in North San Diego County as well.
Yeah, and then we moved to Del Mar, and I left about 62, summer of 62 we left. But it's all different now down there, you know.
Right.
But it was, at one time, Mike, I could ride my horse from Rancho down to Del Mar Beach, to Solana Beach. I could ride him down, walk him over the tracks. There was no freeway through there then. Or I'd ride him the back way to Cardiff, but there was no freeway, so I could just cross the highway.
Right. My great-grandfather grew up in La Jolla and mm-hmm. would talk about taking trips up to Escondido.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a 45-minute drive.
Yeah,
but
well, we'd go to Escondido.
It was a day-long trip.
Absolutely. We'd go to Escondido, two-lane road, to go to Sears Roebuck.
Yes.
My mom would buy us jeans and
I
stuff.
Know where that's at.
Exactly.
Not there anymore.
No. It's all different.
Yes.
And it's too bad. It was heaven growing up there, heaven. But my folks did not care for country music. They listened to big band music, which you probably guys have already seen that. Let me talk about that or heard it. But they were supportive. They were sort of scratching their heads, you know, going, is this our son? You know, because I'd be playing all this stuff. And, you know, it was a great time.
Right.
But that's the Bakersfield sound. And I first heard Buck Owens, my high school janitor in my high school, San Diego High School in Encinitas, California. Bill Smith was the first man to guide me in music. He was a musician on the weekends, played in a little country band. Took me under his wing, one of the sweetest guys in the world. And he showed me the ropes. He was my window on authenticity. And he was a transplanted Oklahoman, I believe. He was one. Vern Gosden and his brother Rex Gosden were a couple. I had a lot of good guys in my life that really showed me the music.
Right. And the music industry has changed a great deal over the past 50 years. Do you think that there's new genres emerging, or is it possible for new genres to emerge, like what happened in Bakersfield?
You know, that's a great question. I would hope so. I would really hope so. And now, the music industry is a matter of, on the artist level, to adapting to all this new technology. I don't have to worry about it anymore, thank God. I was there at just the right time, you know. I mean, we started making records on 8-track analog machines. Oh, the first one I made was a 3-track. So I was there at the right time. Now I don't understand any of it but new genre, I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's so overloaded. There's so many people out there playing. But, you know, I'm still, my heart is in the old-time music, and I was thinking about this the other day. It's a good question, Mike. I love the old styles in all the different types of music. Old country music, old bluegrass, the older blues music, older art, rhythm and blues. Old rock music. And maybe it's just inherent in when you get older that you sort of cling to that time. But I looked at the bluegrass music when I was growing up learning it. I looked at the old masters. Well, they were current then. You know, and yeah, there's some kids out there now that just play rings around everybody. They're unbelievable. That's the good part of it. Are they inventing a new style? I don't know. And they're merging different styles. I don't know where it's all going to go. I really don't.
Yeah, the aspect about listening to the old music is interesting because, you know, maybe it could be because it's already stood the test of time, and maybe 50 years from now, what's coming out now will be considered that in that aspect as well.
Well, that's usually the way it works, and I would hope that happens too. Music's a wonderful thing. We have created such an instant gratification culture, as my old line, dispose of culture, but it's everything is so fast now, and with the internet and all that, and instant communications, and it's hard to have your own little area or your own sound. Now, I have a talk to do at UCLA on April the 16th, I believe it is, and here I am talking to some people that are in a class learning how to be managers in the business now. It's a hard one. I'm going, I don't know what the heck's out there on the horizon. I think the shelf life has been greatly diminished. I mean, yeah, if you reach that plateau where you're Brad Paisley or you're U2 or something like that, you'll have this long run. But it's interesting.
Right.
I mean, I don't see music going away is what I'm trying to get
No.
at.
No.
No, no, no.
My tastes tend to the older stuff, and a lot of, interestingly enough, all the music my folks listen to, I listen to now. Sinatra and Dean Martin and Tony Bennett, who's still certainly viable, and Peggy Lee and Sarah Vaughan and things like that. I find that musically, the lyrics were so good.
And again,
the melodies were so good.
Yeah, and again, artists that have stood the test of time.
Oh,
yeah, they just...
But you see, it's like Johnny Mercer, my hero. What a lyricist. And what did he write? Hundreds and hundreds of incredible songs. But then again, back in those days, the media consisted of radio, really. That was it. Early television. And the movies. So it was more of an area where you really communicated through music.
Right. Now, here's a question. The photo shoot from the Flying Burrito Brothers' Gilded Palace of Sin is pretty much iconic with the use of Nudie Cohen's work. This was arguably the first time rock musicians embraced that imagery of country music. Do you still have your Nudie suit?
I have it, but it's on a sort of a loan to the Gene Autry Museum in Los Angeles at present. In fact, I need to go.
You need to go get that and wear it.
I can't get in it.
Oh, no.
I can't get in that suit to save my soul. I can't. Man, I was a little guy back then, 150 pounds maybe. But
that was great.
You
can get it taken out.
Huh?
You can get it taken out.
Yeah. But Desert Rose Band, we had suits for a while, too. And it's so funny. When we came out in 1987, we had our first success. And 88 or 87 or 1988, we played the Opry, and Bill Anderson was the host that night. And he said, "I'm getting my suits out of the closet. You guys are, you've brought back all the good stuff that the rest of us have forgotten about." And I think a lot of people are sort of back into that. But yeah, it was so funny. You could sort of wear your life on your clothing. You could have a whole landscape of your life. Graham did.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Sneaky Pete had. We were an interesting band. It was one of the stranger bands I've been in. I loved it, and it was an interesting experiment. But we really came out of left field, and no one would play us back then. We barely could get on FM rock. Well, FM rock radio was in its infancy then, but country radio didn't want to know about it.
Right. Well, how much of that aspect do you think the name had to do with that?
Well, that had a lot to do with it, I'm sure. I think they probably thought we were an acrobat team and could have probably passed off as an acrobats, but it was interesting. But here we are now, and the burritos are bigger than ever.
Right.
We didn't get arrested back in 1969, 1970. I look back on those songs Graham Parsons and I wrote. Some of my greatest work was writing with Graham when I had about a year and a half with him, when he was really focused and he was unbelievably talented, very bright, witty, and I lost him. I lost him. We all lost him. He was gone by then and never came back. You know, he was here physically until he died, but he never quite came back. know,
yeah.
I'm sure Emmy Lou would back me up on that. She made a couple good records with him, but it was hard. I think Emmy and I both loved him and tried our best to steer him right, and we couldn't do that.
It was just a train that was just on that track that was going any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, were you aware of the fact that the band was creating a new country rock genre?
Not really. I think, Mike, we were so into country music. I'll tell you a funny little aside. I mean, I remember when the news was brought, footage on Woodstock as it was happening. And the newscasters talking about Woodstock. All these people are out in the field. And Graham and I are sharing a house, and this is right when we were writing all the songs, and we were laughing about it. I said, oh, brother. I said to Graham, I said, I think I was a hippie for 5 minutes. And I said, I wouldn't be back there. And we were just sort of chuckling over, because we were going straight. We were so far removed from the rock scene at that point. We were going down to these country bars in the suburbs of L.A., and we'd sit in, or we'd play, or we'd go to the Palomino Club, or we'd go to the city, I can't remember the name of that other club we used to go. That's where I met J.D. Manus. But all over it was a whole other culture, subculture that we were immersed in. Aces Club, that was it. The Aces Club. So, I mean, those kind of places. Similar to where Buck Owens had started in Bakersfield, those kind of clubs. Tough ones, but pretty darn interesting.
So, Chris, I've been reading up a little bit, and you have advised aspiring musicians to go to college
mm-hmm.
and study what they love.
You bet.
And my question is, if you had gone back to college, what would have been your course of study?
I would have been a history major. I actually did a sort of a half semester at a junior college, and I took political science classes. But I would have been a history major, and still love it, still read it now, just do it on my own. I have great respect for people now that go on to the... Well, here's an example for you. Mark Volman, a very dear friend of mine who was in the Turtles, still in the Turtles, but went back to school in his 40s. He got his... associate, what is it, arts, whatever, the first degree. Got his bachelor's degree, got his master's degree, ended up teaching at Loyola Marymount University, music classes, and still plays in the Turtles. But my point is, this particular time, you need to have that to fall back on. And I've never told one person who's asked my advice to give up music. I say, keep playing. Play wherever you can. Don't assume you're going to get paid. Just play wherever you can. Do it for the joy and love of the music. But go to school. Get something you can fall back on. And it's a different world now than when I started.
Right. Now, are there any other songwriters or musicians out there that you would like to work with or collaborate with but haven't yet?
Oh, gosh. There's a lot of them, but I don't know. I couldn't really tell you. I mean, I really like... I love Brad Paisley's sense of humor in his songwriting. I think he's a really terrific, wonderful guy too. I like Dwight Yoakam a lot. I always liked Dwight from the time he first came out. He was what Graham could have been. Dwight Yoakam is what Graham Parsons could have been if he'd had Dwight's focus and work ethic. But Dwight did it. He did it all, and he's a darn good actor too. So I like his work a lot. But I don't know. It's a tough question to answer. So there's a lot of people I really admire. But I'm sort of on the downward spiral. I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, music is important. I love playing. It's a blessing to be able to go out and play. And Herb and I go out and we do 5 or 6, 7 days a month, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks sometimes. Not very much. But we enjoy it. And it's been a long run. In 2 more years, I'll have 50 years playing music. Will I do another album? Maybe. I don't know, but...
Coming up to the Bay Area this summer.
Yeah.
And you have a date with Herb Peterson at the Fillmore on Saturday, June 25th in San Francisco.
That's right, the old Fillmore with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, old friends of ours, and I don't think I've been in the Fillmore in 40 years, maybe 40, yeah, about 40 years.
Well, hopefully it looks better than the last time you
were
there.
Yeah, so too. I'm with you on that. My audience, people that come to see us, they like to sit down. So I don't know if that's a stand-up place or what.
Toss some chairs out there.
I could throw some chairs out there. Yeah. So you have a date later in the summer with the Desert Rose Band, but I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the new album at Edwards Barn and talk a little bit about that for folks.
Well, that was recorded. Every year, Herb and I have been doing a benefit for a church building up in Napomo, which is a town just south of Santa Maria, California. Once again, agricultural area, more towards the coast. And there's this wonderful venue, Edwards Barn. Well, it wasn't a venue per se as a club, but it was out always something you could rent out for different events that you held. That's where the church would put the benefit show on that we would do. But it was just so acoustically perfect in there, and it was like 3 years ago. I said, boy, I hope maybe we can do a live album in here. And we got to do that. So that's what we did. We just basically went in and recorded our show one night and patched up a few things, and there you have it. It was just us playing. It was as real as you can get.
That sounds great.
And you do some bluegrass versions of previous songs that you've recorded with the Byrds or the Burrito Brothers, too.
Well, only in the instrumentation. I never took the Liberties with 8 Miles High, which was a great cut, one of the ones I'm proud to have been playing bass on back in the Byrds. We just played it with acoustic instruments. We didn't change the arrangement. But yeah, and that's when you said different genres, the instrumentation, let's say a bluegrass band, you're marked forever if you have a banjo in the band. That's it.
Or a
bluegrass band. Yeah. But take those instruments and go into different areas. And a lot of these young groups are doing that. They're taking and going into a different genre, exactly the right word, of music, and taking material out of that area and fusing it with this kind of instrumentation. That's what we did.
Well, I was going to, you kind of answered this, but I wanted to know sort of what's next on your plate. What's next for Chris Hillman?
Well, Amanda, I just take each day. But, you know, I love speaking, so I've got the next thing coming up quickly, probably in April 16th, I believe, is the coming Saturday soon. I don't know when are you guys broadcasting?
We're broadcasting this this Thursday, so it'll be the 14th.
The 14th. Well, there you go. This Saturday I'll be speaking at this class at UCLA. So I do those things. I spoke at a school in Point Loma. Mike, you'd know where that is.
Oh, yeah.
San Diego and Point Loma Nazarene University at a writer's symposium, which was really interesting because it was there was this very famous writer, Mary Carr, that was there too, and I got to talk to her. She's very bright, very, very a wonderful writer. I read a couple of her books, and she's a poet, and she's a professor, the dean of literature at Syracuse University. But anyway, point being, I'm doing a lot of that. I love doing it. And working with Herb is great. And I would imagine we will do another record somewhere down the road.
Sounds good. Well, hopefully we can lure you up here sometime live in studio. That would be a real
We'd
treat
love
for
to.
Us.
We'll come up and play for you. And that's the great part of playing acoustically. You know, we can go into any radio station anywhere in the world and play mandolin and guitar. You can't get any purer than that, down to the basic essence of the music. And I tell people when we play shows, and I'll tell everybody in your audience that when you hear Herb and I play, this is the way that the songs were originally conceived and written, on instruments like the mandolin or the guitar. I don't play the piano, but if I did, I probably would have written on piano. But that's it. That's what they're hearing, only in a little more polished version.
Right. So when you're writing songs, you're writing with either the guitar or the mandolin.
Yeah, more with the guitar. But I have written a couple tunes around the mandolin. It seems to work. It's an interesting element there to bring into the mix.
Well, we sure appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us, and we look forward to airing this in the future, and it'll also go up on our blog site.
That's great. Thanks so much for having me on your show, and I'll see you soon, I hope.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
Adios.
Thanks,
all right,
Chris.
Bye-bye.